Hi, my name's Pete Knapp, an air quality PhD student at Imperial College London. This series of podcasts is kindly promoted by the Grantham Institute, the college's hub for climate change and environment. Subscribe to receive future episodes and contact the Grantham Institute on Twitter with @Grantham_IC and me with @PeteK_AQ. This is Tipping Points, a podcast featuring interviews with people who've become environmental activists. What made them change? What are they doing now? And what do they hope to see in the future as we face possible breakdown of civilization and life on Earth? This first series focuses on scientists in the UK. With me in this episode is Dr. Alex Penson from London. Welcome.
Hi, Pete. Yeah, thanks for having me.
I wonder if you could give me your life story in 3 minutes.
So I really enjoyed science subjects at school, trained in physics. My first experience of activism was the Iraq War March. A couple of million people came out, and then nothing happened. That, I think, was a bit of a turn-off for quite a long time. 2008 or something was when I first got a sense of the climate and ecological situation, how big it was, I guess, like the scale of it. And I particularly remember back then reading this book called Sustainable Energy Without the Hot Air, which has lots and lots of approximate calculations of how you could power a society using renewables only. And it's hard. Like, you can do it, but using energy the way that we currently do is really hard. It was that and a number of other things showed me that the way that the subject is talked about in the news is entirely wrong. It's not just about, oh, we're not doing quite enough. Oh, we should be doing a bit more of this. It's like, no. This is going to involve sweeping changes. Like, we absolutely cannot carry on the way that we are doing. Because these are energy calculations, right? There's nothing that you can argue with, right? So that had a big impact on me. Yeah, I really went down a bit of a sort of obsessive rabbit hole.
How old were you at the time in 2008?
Early 20s. Since then, I've felt like I was in the know. I didn't know what I could do. I didn't have any, couldn't think of any way that I could contribute to it. Definitely felt powerless, but also I guess I convinced myself things like flying being immoral because it wasn't going to be sustainable. But then I took a job on a different continent from my family, so seems like inconsistent behavior. So I switched at that point to studying cancer biology using new sequencing technologies.
Why did you decide to take a job in that direction when climate was so important to you?
it's an interesting question. I think both felt important. I still can feel proud of the work that my colleagues and I do. There was quite a big change 2 or 3 years ago. Like, for a long time, I was in quite a competitive environment. Like, the work was never done. That became really stressful. And I lost my job eventually, and my current role is more supporting my colleagues who are experimental biologists. So it's the same basic field, but it's quite a different mindset. But if I have a little time, a little creative energy left at the end of the day, it just feels like there's a million possible things to do. Just the scope for me contributing just feels huge. So that's such a contrast to my earlier attitude. You know, I filled out a form on a XR website just saying that I was interested to help out, and then shortly after got a cold call basically saying, do I want to set up a kitchen as part of one of those 2-week rebellions? I hadn't done anything like that before. Didn't really know much about the task. I don't know. It seemed odd, but it seemed curious. So that was my introduction to XR. And it was exciting. Like, I recruited tons of people into some sort of Telegram chat and tried to get hold of some kitchen equipment. It was, again, a roller coaster. Like, did manage to get the equipment. Then it got confiscated. Then on the day, a lot of people showed up and we really did manage to feed lots and lots of folks.
Now, you've been involved a lot in Money Rebellion. Can you tell us a bit about that?
The financial system is a cause of this whole thing. Many features of international finance, you know, things that we take for granted, like, you know, joint stock companies and consolidated bonds and things like that. These were really set up to enable colonization, basically. You know, this was in the early 1700s before the steam engine, right? It was set up in order to extract wealth. And I mean, that for folks in the West, that has generated a lot of wealth. But now it feels a bit like the Sorcerer's Apprentice, right? We can't turn it off. The idea of Money Rebellion is to make people think differently about growth imperative and the different institutions that are benefiting from fossil fuel production. Central banks, for example, the Bank of England, you know, has the power to regulate banks and to impose reserve requirements on risky behavior. Part of their job is to try and mitigate climate and ecological risks. They should, in principle, impose reserve requirements on banks that are engaging in behaviors that lead to climate risks, such as financing, you know, underwriting fossil fuel companies. They don't do this. They absolutely don't do that. And so I feel like the Bank of England is an excellent target because they are, you know, in principle, a public institution. They work for us. It's interesting. So the Bank of International Settlements refers to itself as a bank for central banks. They've referred to climate risks as unhedgeable without system-wide transformation, which just feels to me, I don't know, that's horrifying. I feel like it's phrases like that that really sort of cut through to the point I made earlier about, you know, this being just touching on every aspect and requiring such a huge shift. Most of these companies are stuck in a situation where they are debt financed. That is then feeling like there is something sort of fundamentally wrong. Not just one thing, like there are many things that are fundamentally wrong with society. Yeah, the Bank of England, right, says on its website, just it will send you a little document that says like, oh yes, our policies are aligned with a temperature rise of 3.5 degrees, right? And then you go over to the scientific literature and it's like, oh, 3.5 degrees will bring like a high probability of like a cascade of like tipping points, which will put civilization at risk. And you're like, wait, high probability.
That.
Yeah, it says that.
3.5 degrees on the website.
Yeah.
What?
And you're like, wait a sec, the Bank of England, they make the money, don't they? Don't they make the money? It's like, yeah, they do. They're pretty central to this whole enterprise, aren't they? It's like, oh mate.
Jeez, I didn't know that. I didn't know they were actually advertising how much of a misunderstanding they have of what they're doing.
So I did, this was over the Christmas holidays, I did a bit of a sort of unscientific research about the single fact that most got to that point of like, something is very wrong. I was trying to write a letter to someone, maybe it was my MP or something like that. So I wanted to just in a single sort of short sentence capture the idea that something is very wrong, that we need a change in kind, you know, not just like a little bit more of this, a little bit more of that. No, we need to stop. We need to totally rethink. And yeah, based on just a few discussions with, not entirely sympathetic family members, people that are, you know, quite prepared to listen, but not a total pushover. the stat about the Bank of England, that one hit home, because I think everyone has heard in the media, usually it's just, oh, you know, is it 1.5? Is it 2 degrees? Paris Agreement says stay below 2 degrees. I think people pretty much absorbed that. Quite clearly, 3.5 is not that at all. I think, you know, I think it's quite clear that 3.5 is really very different to 2 degrees. Even though they sound like small numbers, I think people have gathered that, or that at least people in my unscientific survey were surprised, and you, by the sounds of it, were surprised by, like, wait a second, I didn't realize that. That's very wrong. And I'm like, aha. I'll send you the letter from Rishi Sunak as well, where he says that he changes the Bank of England's mandate. Their primary objective now explicitly includes mitigating climate and ecological risks.
What do you mean?
Well, so the Bank of England, for all of its history, has been set up to create a stable economy, basically. That's the point. I mean, that's what a central bank is all about. Managing the economy such that it is stable. That's what it's there for. If ever they were called out on the fact that they had this document that said that their portfolio was aligned with 3.5 degrees, their response to that was, well, you know, we're sorry, we recognize this as a problem, but our mandate, you know, our sort of legal box that we're in is to look after the stability of the economy. That's what we do. You know, we can't just reach out, wade out into dealing with climate and ecological issues. You know, we're a bank. But now, as of, you know, just a month or two ago, their mandate explicitly includes mitigating climate and ecological risks. And the Bank of International Settlements referred to climate risks as uninsurable, basically. Oh, mitigated climate risks. Oh, yeah, those are uninsurable. Those are unmitigatable risks. Like, oops. And I think you know that, right? Because, like, if your city is underwater, like, you can't insure that away. Like, if one city is underwater, then other cities can sort of rally around and, you know, try and, I don't know what, rebuild it or something. Like, if there's a localized disaster, then this has happened throughout history, right? You know, if one village gets burnt down or something, then the neighboring villages will come to some arrangement to rebuild the village. You know, it may not be a fair arrangement, but, you know, there'll be some sort of structure, some sort of agreement in place to try and absorb risks like that. That's something that leads to globalization, that leads to, anyway, yeah, obviously, if this is something that then affects the whole, then it's not insurable, like, in the same way. It's unhedgeable in the jargon.
For this topic, especially when everything is so connected, and you don't want to overwhelm your audience by going through the real detail of everything, I wonder if you've found that you've tried different approaches, and sometimes they've worked well with some people and sometimes they've not worked quite so well.
As a scientist, if I can just come out with the latest horrifying fact, I increasingly try not to do that. I am concerned that the horrifying facts do have the effect of scaring people, like, they work. But scaring people most of the time is not the right approach. Like, a lot of people, most people in society by polling, like, recognize that there is a climate emergency and that something should be done about it. Scaring people more tends to make people look after their own, to make people less inclined towards more complex solutions that maybe take negotiating. The more you use that kind of emergency framing, people will respond to, like, top-down solutions, which I guess means sort of authoritarianism, right? And I think that is maybe true in the aftermath of crises, right? Like, if you put people in the mindset of a crisis, like a flood has come through, in situations like that, it's usually external companies, big organizations that are able to recover in situations with local shocks, right? So even if people respond with more community in the immediate aftermath of a crisis, often the longer term effect is big organizations taking more control. Like, anyway, that's it. I guess local shocks and natural disasters generally don't lead to constructive social change. The inspiring message there is that the thing that historically has led to social change is, you know, a minority of committed individuals.
People would say that after the Second World War, lots of things had changed for the benefit of society. And when a crisis like that happens, that's an opportunity for system change. And people are calling for that after COVID to say, you know, grow back better, build back better, something. We can see some evidence of this. But as you're saying, when you have these global companies who are all putting pressure on keeping things as they are, whereas after the Second World War, that may not have been such a big issue. And so bigger changes could have happened. What do you think about that framing?
After the Second World War was an unusual time when inequality went down, right? Before the Second World War, in Europe at least, Europe and America, inequality had been really high. Whereas in the 50s, it was then lower. And now it's been, or since the 50s, 60s, it's been going up and up. It feels at a level that cannot continue, right? So this is how I see this as all part of the same kind of issue. For example, yeah, during COVID, like even though most of the economy was actually shut down, like the stock market carried on going up and up. A lot of these feel like examples where the conventional, like international finance, has become increasingly divorced from reality.
When people are joining Money Rebellion, how empowered do they feel in being able to make change? Because presumably people can change their bank, right? Does that send enough of a message?
That's a great question. Well, I mean, Money Rebellion has lots of tactics. There are some end up with news stories. They've had amazingly positive coverage. For example, the window smashing action in The Telegraph, for example, The Sun, The Daily Mail. On the other hand, there's a whole range of different protests. There's something for everyone, right? We are doing an income tax protest and council tax strikes, for example. I think these are exciting. Historically, tax strikes have been very, very effective. The suffragettes used it, but also, you know, going way, way, way back, the Magna Carta, right, was originally a tax strike. Then stickering, for example. You can just order some stickers and then go and stick them on your local ATM. So yeah, that's me. I'm a scientist. I'm recommending our listeners to go out and vandalize your local ATM. What makes the difference for me is that it's part of like a coordinated and joyful, frankly, social movement. There are clear, achievable goals of getting banks to cut ties with fossil fuel companies. Student divestment movement, that's been a campaign over 10 or more years to get universities to take their endowments out of fossil fuels. So I think that those have been huge symbolic victories for campaigners, but I think the understanding is that the financial implications are modest. Whereas the short-term financing that fossil fuel companies get from banks like Barclays and HSBC is more important to them. And so the idea is that we can humiliate retail banks into cutting their ties, and this will have a really valuable effect. So that's you with the sticker, sticking it to the ATM. And it's just a simple act of just saying, I'm not okay with this.
Do you think that sends enough of a message to the banks, though?
It's small in its own. I think that's it. So a lot of the things that you would do with XR seem really mundane on their own, but they add up to a compelling whole, right? You can imagine one sticker on one ATM, like the banks are just, I mean, they're not even going to know, they're going to roll their eyes. But if there's a really sort of sustained months-long campaign of people all around the country, in fact, all around the world, just saying, I'm not okay with this. You know, Barclays and HSBC pouring billions into fossil fuels is killing all of us. We're not okay with this.
It'd be really interesting to hear more about your when you were at the demonstration at the Bank of England, because I think the headline was four arrested after Extinction Rebellion attacked the Bank of England with crude oil or something like that. What was that like?
Yeah, that was the first time for ages that I've been part of a protest like that. I thought the April Fools were really great. That didn't get picked up in the media too much. So the Punch character, right? Like he typically says in Punch and Judy shows, Punch says that's the way to do it. But this Punch, of course, said that's not the way to do it. And they were like prancing around in these outfits, you know, they've got like hats with little bells on it. And just talking about, you know, the Bank of England and all their bailouts that like during coronavirus, people in this country have been out of work, have been going hungry. And the Bank of England's bailing out Rolls Royce. Rolls Royce. And Punch says, that's not the way to do it. Oh, brilliant. I think making that kind of stuff funny is quite an achievement. So there was the comedy element of that one at the Bank of England, but also there were these windows. So the Bank of England doesn't have any windows for security purposes, apparently. So we placed these windows in the in some little alcoves. So the idea is that it's, you know, you're seeing what's really going on inside.
And of course, it wasn't just in England, right? It happened around the world.
Oh man, the one in France was lovely, yeah, because they sent some climbers that actually managed to get up onto a little balcony and drop down this huge banner, and they had smoke flares, and they were just dropping, like, just scattering money. It just brings a tear to the eye. I think I hadn't realized that it would be in multiple countries when I went to the action, so I think that, again, makes it feel really, really compelling.
How important do you think the role of comedy is, then, in demonstrations?
I think it's important. I think it's really important to make to keep the mood light. There can be just creativity or just something a little bit clever or sly. I think XR's generally been really good at that.
Have you heard of the BBC iPlayer series called Can't Get You Out of My Head?
By Adam Curtis? Yeah, I watched that. I found it frustrating at first. Like, he darts between, what is it, Zhang Qing from China, and then Michael X, and then and he's trying to make these very obscure connections between these different people. I really enjoyed the first Adam Curtis that I watched. It is called Century of the Self. It talks about how pervasive psychoanalytical techniques became starting from the Second World War. He makes a compelling case about the extent to which businesses and advertisers used in advertising. He particularly talks about the focus group. Focus groups, of course, you get some people together, you get learn how they feel about the product. You try and ask them sort of just random questions, get them to do role playing and stuff about the object instead of just you present them with the object. That was previously how advertising had gone. You give someone a new object, like, oh, we have this washing up detergent, what do you think about it? And the person would say, well, detergent A is slightly better than detergent B. That was how advertising had gone. After the war, it was more like, well, what does detergent mean to you? Like, et cetera, et cetera. And then later episodes of that series are about political focus groups, which really became a big thing in like the 80s, and how candidates, instead of saying like, I am the best candidate, here are all my policies, I have policy A, policy B, policy C. Instead, it was like, but how do you feel about the candidate? Like, oh, does he seem like on your team? Does he seem like a guy that you'd like to have a beer with, etc.? And that's how politics has become increasingly focus grouped, etc. Critique of modern society.
I wonder if he might be persuaded to do something of a similar style that actually does hit home with the breadth and the complexity and so on of the climate crisis. Could that style be, you know, effective in with this message?
It certainly could. Oh, I really think it could. I assume that there are people that have been, people have tried to persuade him. I don't know. Maybe at some point he'll go on a bit of a journey. Like, I think like David Attenborough, I guess, is another sort of public figure who you might have thought would be more on board with radical change over the last whatever 10 years and was always very resistant to like, no, I think things are mostly fine. It's like, what are you talking about? And I feel like he has gone on a real journey over the last couple of years, right? So yeah, maybe one day, maybe when Adam Curtis is 96, he'll go on a similar journey. I don't know. Blue Planet 2 had a whole episode about plastic and had an albatross like puking up a bunch of plastic bags and stuff. And it was horrible. And that really had an enormous effect on the way that supermarkets cut back on. Like, there was a huge sort of public uproar about single-use plastic, right? And I mean, you can argue about how constructive that is. But I think when Attenborough and the whatever BBC Nature team put out compelling content, like, it really hits home. I mean, you know, millions of people watch it, and it really can have a strong effect. Most recent episodes most recent programs just in the last whatever year or two, there was Extinction the Facts. That's brutal. It's a totally different tone, and it does really talk about large-scale solutions. I think even that one frustrated me because in the later scenes they just have, you know, some pictures of politicians in suits at a conference dealing with the ozone layer. I mean, the hole in the ozone layer. And they say, like, oh, yes, well, but, you know, we've got some crises now, but look at these politicians that went to this conference and decided not to use CFCs or whatever. And that's, again, just so frustrating. Like, that's the message that you're going to leave people with. Seriously, like, you've had 40 minutes of TV about, like, how, like, all marine life is just in an absolute downward trajectory. Just, you know, 90% by weight is humans and livestock. Yeah, after going into so much detail about that, your solution is like, oh, yeah, well, pretty much politicians are just going to fix it. It's like, what are you saying? That's so annoying. Yeah, so one even more recent than Extinction, the fact that did cover like advocacy. Even the series is A Perfect Planet. It was out beginning of this year. The last episode is called Humans, and it had some pictures of student activists like waving signs. But it doesn't even that like doesn't put the viewer. It doesn't give the viewer a role, right? It leaves the impression that the viewer is not a participant. Right? It's just sort of presenting the situation. It's like, oh yes, we have the situation, and like, well, it could go either way, you know, like we could have the better future or we could have the bad future. And it's like, so it's presenting the situation. It's like, oh well, it's a really dramatic scenario. It's like you're at the end of a sports game or something, and you know, well, it could go either way, it's gonna come down to the wire kind of thing. And oh yes, there are these students that are on the field, you know. But it's like, it's not like you, the viewer, are on the field. You can do something, you know, like, and wouldn't that be like a more positive, hopeful message, right? To leave the viewer feeling like they are part of something bigger than themselves, right? Right. Rather than just like, this is just more content you can stream to your TV and, you know, well, it could go either way. And then you just flip over to the next channel. It's like, well, here's a, you know, oh, it's like MasterChef. Like, oh, is Johnny going to win or is Andy going to win? It's like, it could go either way. It's like, oh. But so close. It's close, right? They have actual advocates on the nature program saying, like, nature is important to me. I'm going and waving a sign.
Fascinating chat, Alex. Thank you very much for that.
Oh, yeah. Thanks.
Music from Climate by Eric Ian Walker, commissioned by the Climate Music Project, who communicate the sense of urgency of the climate and ecological crises through the emotional power of music. More to be found at ericianwalker.bandcamp.com and climatemusic.org.